I'm going to put on the recorder now, Lori.
Okay.
And let me just find my other, I have a backup that I use for the transcription. And I'll do a welcome when we get all set up here. Let me just press the right buttons. Here we go. So on this Buddha's birthday, it's my pleasure to welcome Lori Bashor. I call you Bashor because I don't know if that's
the way. My name.
Mm-hmm. Bashor. Mm-hmm. And this is the interview on May the 7th for the upcoming publication by Singing Dragon Press of a book whose working title is Yoga Radicals, Inspiring Stories from Pioneers in the Field. And so what I'd like to do at the beginning, Lori, is to go through the 5-point star model of the prototyping model that this question series is invited from. Okay. And this is from the Presencing Institute. Okay. And I'm so excited that you're here because you'll be one of about 3 couples who I've interviewed. And it's not uncommon for there to be a question mark about influence in these couples who have not quite figured out how this particular creative energy has grounded the growth of yoga. So I'm going to say that directly to you because I know you as a creatrix. And just for our readers, Lori and I met in the swimming pool one early morning. I believe it was a sitar, was down in Reston. Mm-hmm. And it could have been the very sitar where the inaugural CIC was.
Yeah.
So that was 2018. Mm-hmm. So, and that's significant because it's water, okay, the creative aspect. Yeah. So taking a deep breath in as we ground, and then I'll launch into the 5-pointed star. So just let's get some creative sacred space. Taking a breath in, perhaps remembering swimming together in the same body of water, Lori. I think Amy Wheeler was in the pool that morning too. And just allowing yourself to feel the ground, this springtime earth. And this quality of connection of all that is as I'm liking to say these days, shred and then thread the treasures of our knowing through these portals of awareness that continue to open over and over again. More and more detail each time as we review the essence of our practices, of who we truly are, but more importantly, who we are all becoming together in this great time. Just thinking and feeling and sensing. Arms, legs, toes, fingers, space. And I invite you, Lori, to add any other words, inviting your guides and angels into the space that we share in this conversation too.
I have nothing and no expectations.
Thank you. So the prototyping core principles and practices, these 5 points that we'll touch on through the questions, relate to how a crystallizing of a vision or intention comes to life, kind of like a divine spark of something, an idea, and how it's helped by listening to the universe through practices or contemplation. And then as it lands and begins to link all of the intelligences of the head, the heart, and the hand doing things, the questions move toward, well, who else? Who's the core team that's been part of this embodiment that you've been able to be part of? And then where and how? What were the places and spaces? We'll talk about a little bit. We don't have to land a lot in that now that we're going virtual. But where did these ideas begin to land in real time, and with whom? And then what was it, this more rhythmic trying and trying again, this failing fast we call in leadership? Did it happen? So these points of light that began to continuously refine, crystallize into forms through the school, Phoenix Rising Yoga, and also what you, Lori, as an individual embedded within that, can land in that's true to the who you are and what your particular offer is. And so as you link into that aspect of who you are, knowing that it's always within the relational field that many things happen, but at this beginning place now, Lori, to find your shape, your voice, your offer, so that we and the readers in the future can hear from you, knowing that it will be a balance, as it has been throughout. So this first question, just like this invocation that we've just been going through, right, is what was this amazing inspiration that emerged in you? What did you know as it hit you, this divine spark? What did you think? What did you feel? What did you sense as you basically said yes to this idea and letting it land in you, this quality of being this leader in the yoga world?
Am I? Yeah, this is kind of terrifying.
Stay with it.
I went to Kripalu in 1985. I had never done yoga. I was a dancer, and I was in my body since I was 4 years old. I was a professional dancer, and I had never done yoga. Of course, I stretched and was very flexible all the time. And I was pretty stressed out living in New York City, and Kripalu Center had moved to Lenox from Sumneytown, but between Sumneytown and moving to Lenox, they did these things called outreach back then in the 80s. And one of the places they would do outreach was Dayton, Ohio. I think it was Sukanya who went out there. And I'm from Ohio. And so my mom and dad were going to these marriage counseling things, marriage retreats, and these things were at the same place. And so my dad went to one of these things, and my parents had me very young. So they were like 40, and Kripalu moved to Lenox and decided to run this program called Health for Life. So it was this program sold as like, get healthy, you get 2 massages a week, and you do yoga, and you learn to cook macrobiotic and all these things. So my dad sent my mom and I for this 3-week program. And I went there from my apartment in New York for 3 weeks. The long and the short of it is, I'll go into the details, but I actually never left. Like when I went there, that started my new life. And Kripalu at the time was, I guess, full-blown ashram with the white clothing at 7 p.m., the getting up every day at 5 a.m. But I wasn't in that. I was in, a lot of people went to Kripalu because they were seeking, and were seeking for the spiritual aspects of yoga and seeking a yogic lifestyle and seeking to live in an ashram. I didn't even know it was an ashram. I went because my dad sent me and it was a spa. So for 3 weeks, we were in the luxury places on the fourth floor with our private bathrooms and everything. And we even had our own kitchen and our own chef because we were learning how to cook macrobiotic foods. So Chandra Khan, actually, who is now with Amrit, he runs the Amrit Center, and he was teaching us cooking back then. Since you wanted names, I'll just mention the names. And it was run by Pat Karpfen Malti and tall, blonde, short hair. She still teaches there, really famous. I'll think of her name, a lovely person who still teaches at Kripalu.
Suda,
yeah, who I know very well. What's her English name?
Caroline.
So they were the two running it. And we also had Prabhakar was the doctor. There was two doctors. So we had a doctor. We had all of these things. And Linda Jackson, Anuradha, was my yoga teacher, our yoga teacher. And the first time I took a yoga class, so of course I'm really flexible. But taking a yoga class and hearing these words, there's nowhere to go, nothing to do. Like those were the words that rang for me, because I was always trying to get somewhere, always doing things, always living for tomorrow. Go, you know, go to this audition, get this job. Oh, when that happens then. So my whole life was based on when that happens, then it will be all right. And it created a lot of stress that I didn't even know. I was sort of going crazy and living on pizza and yogurt and cheese and stuff. It's very unhealthy. So when I heard there's nowhere to go, nothing to do, it just kept ringing in my mind. There's nowhere to go, nothing to do. And I just landed. And for the first time in my life, I had a massage. I think I was 25. So that was my first massage. Massage wasn't really out then. And it was an amazing experience. And just getting in, it was the first time I was not using my body as a tool. And I was being in my body. And it was the first time I was hearing the words of being in this moment, being present. There's nowhere to go and nothing to do, going on walks in the woods. And everything about my life just like surrendered into it. And I found that this was a place that I wanted to live. Like the place inside of me was a place I wanted to live. And because everyone at Kripalu was living it that way, I was attracted to staying, and so I did. And what I was attracted to, it wasn't the spiritual aspect of the yoga that didn't really get me yet, but it was like, wow, you wake up in the morning and you just do your yoga, and then there's breakfast, and then you just do your work, and then there's lunch, and then you just do your work, and then there's dinner, and then you go take a shower, and you come back, and you get to dance in these white robes and sing and listen to the guru talk. And so it was this like blissful existence. Which sounds like a blissful existence if that was actually what was happening every day. But what was really happening was, and I guess they would call it cleansing. At Kripalu, you never got sick, you were cleansing. But what was happening was everything underneath was getting triggered. So I was in veggie prep and I could have argument, like it was stressful in bed. Like so the ashram life recreates the same things that I had in my life. So I had these things that I had to look at about myself and have them reflected back to me. And if I heard one more person say, oh, you're having a hard time with that person because they're reflecting something about you, I was going to shoot them. But it was the truth, you know. So there was this blissful existence with this excruciatingly painful inner process as well. It's not actually so easy to just wake up every day and do that because all your shit comes up. And so even just chopping vegetables, washing dishes, And it was in the time when you couldn't, the women were on one side and the men were on the other side, and you weren't really meant to speak to the opposite sex except for work related things. But somewhere in that time, something touched inside of me. I think it was before I actually moved in. Something touched inside of me that said, I want to do this work for the rest of my life. Like, I just want to be here for the rest of my life. I want to be in this for the rest of my life. And this is what I'm going to do. And so I never went back to my apartment in New York. I went, moved everything out and came back and moved in.
Okay.
That was my wake up moment. Like, that's not when Phoenix Rising started, but that was when it woke up.
Beautiful. For me to do that. So this context, right, that you landed in, that somehow called you for whatever reason. This next question, and you already spoke about it, is that you began to feel a different connection than what had happened before. And so this initiation starts to enter or it become more part of your daily practice. How did this next step, this clarification of wanting to take that desire further into the world, how did you move forward? Who did you ask for help?
Well, there was a great power in what happened for me, the wake up. So the waking up was such a powerful moment for me, from it'll all be all right when, and there's nowhere to go, nothing to do. It's all here right now. That was life changing for me, like physically life changing for me. And I wanted to bring that moment to others. It's like, I just discovered this great movie. You have to go see it. Or, you know, it was this thing that was alive inside of me. So it was that I felt driven to share the wake up moments with people. And I've always been, even to this day, my favorite place to work is at the wake up moments. I don't know if that's the right word, but the moment when one is awakening from where they are in, it might be a cliche to say darkness, but a different perspective, and then opening up to themselves. And I had never looked at myself before and examined myself before, especially with the men and women separate. That's huge, because I noticed how much I relate to men more than women in this time. I wanted to go to the man all the time and not to the women. And so this had me processing that. And so the other women that were there at the time was this amazing sisterhood, and they called each other sisters and brothers. But what's the question again? That was the beginning of it, but.
Yeah, as you began to clarify your intention to do more from these places of initiation and wake up, how did it begin to mature in you to formulate toward action that would be in service to the world?
Okay.
And how did you know that you could help?
So this is actually my truth, and it's not fresh in my mind today. So you're making me remember back 35 years ago. I had a really hard time at the ashram with the guru thing, the kissing the feet. They did the whole on yogurt on the Shiva ceremonies and stuff. And I was just like, what the fuck is going on here? But it was fun and it was exciting. So I was just like surrendered to it. And so there was this learning about the power of surrendering to someone else. So there was this surrender. A lot of people today have a really hard time with the namaste and the bowing and the guru bowing. The way I internalized that was, I was learning to, I'm Catholic raised, and I believe in God, always had and had this strong spiritual connection, whether or not it's in the Catholic religion, that's beside the point. But I interpreted and was taught and took the teachings into me, I'm surrendering to my higher self. I'm surrendering to the higher in you. So I'm surrendering to what I'm being, like, I'm surrendering to the will of God, is the way we would say it. I'm surrendering to God's will. I'm surrendering to God's will. So internalizing that spiritually, yogically, the guru does represent, like, I'm surrendering to the guru, but I never surrendered to the guru and did everything he said. I even got kicked out of the ashram. That's another story. But but I surrendered to myself, and I realized I got the power of letting go and surrendering and trusting the will of the universe and the will of my spirit. And that the strength was in following my intuition. If I'm led somewhere, I recognize I'm being led somewhere and I'm just going to go there wholeheartedly, all in. And so what happened was, I was really attracted to the families. There were families that lived at the ashram, and there was five girls. They were all 13. They're all 45 now. They lived there. These teenagers living in an ashram, and I felt really kind of bad for them. Like, they're living in this ashram. They can't even go to the movies, you know? So I had been coaching gymnastics in my previous life over there. So I said, hey, you guys, let's learn gymnastics. So in the big cushy, you know, carpeted room, we would go in there and do gymnastics. And I became friends with the girls. And Michael and his wife, who came to the ashram for Australia, were getting divorced. And his daughter was one of these girls. And his wife had come and met someone in the ashram. They fell in love, and that's their story. But Michael was going through this divorce. And Kieran, his daughter, he wanted to go out. She said, you need to go out. So he wanted to go out. So he said, who could babysit? So she got me to babysit. So I met Michael from babysitting for them. But before then, I had seen him. And I believe in the sparkles or the twinkles. Like, I saw him in something in my mind, something inside of me sparkled. But he was married, and so I never went there. But I babysat. And then he went out, but then we started liking each other. That's when our spark started. So I believed in that spark. So everyone at the ashram was like, no. I even had to go. So I went in to sit with Amrit. I had to go to his house and talk to him. And he just kind of looked at me as like, what do you want? And I said, well, I want to be a dancer. I don't know. Maybe I'll do. He's like, no, what do you want? Like, why are you with him? Why are you, don't you know he's getting divorced? And he was just like rolling his eyes. And so they created this thing. It's like, do you want to stay here? And I said, sure, this is great. I want to stay here. But I was at this like surface level place. I wasn't even upset. And so they offered me this opportunity to stay by going to Sumney Town. And his wife, Mataji, had cancer at the time. And I had learned to cook macrobiotic from Chandrakant. So I went to Sumney Town and I worked in their house cooking meals for her. And it was at the time when Kamini was getting married. So I was like behind the veil at the ashram. And it was only about a month, but it seems like this whole lifetime. And I loved every second of it. I was in Mataji's bedroom. She had all these spiritual things. And my job was cleaning and dusting everything, as well as the cooking in the kitchen. And, you know, Kamini's there eating ice cream and being sassy and being a teenager. She wasn't getting married. Her brother was. She was in high school. Her brother was getting, there was this wedding going on and relatives. And I also, my job was also to clean in Muktidham, which is where Bapaji had come and meditated. So one day I had dusted in Mataji's room and just doing all this great cleaning. And then I dusted in Muktidham, and I was walking through the woods. And as I was walking through the woods, I went into molecules, and my body no longer existed. And I was just like that thing you see of a Van Gogh, what's the painting, Monet, where it's all the little dots. I became all the little dots and part of the woods, and I wasn't there anymore. And I was just breathing like, holy shit, what what is this? But I felt that, and I just kind of became one with everything. And I started going up there and praying, because part of why I was there was that was to separate me from Michael and to get clear about what I wanted to do in my life, to help me with this clarity. But I felt really attracted to being with him. But I thought, oh, that's just my head. And everybody in the ashram was saying, don't go be with Michael. So I started going up when I was cleaning in Muktidham, and I would stop. And I didn't meditate because I didn't really know meditation. I knew prayer. So I would pray for guidance, and I would keep praying, you know, what should I do? What should I do? And the message just kept coming really strongly. Go be with Michael, go be with Michael, go be with Michael. And so I just believed, I was like, I don't care what all these people are saying around here. That's what's coming to me in my heart. And that's what's coming to me when I pray. So I went back and I moved out of the ashram, and him and I moved in together immediately. And then that's where we, that's it.
Okay. So let's just take a pause here. I love that the readers will be able to have that sense of you doing sacred work for the guru. And that the experience, which is what this question is centered around, is not just your initiation, but now co-initiation. That we don't do this work alone in the world, and that it's the learning of this move from a me place. And you so beautifully spoke about the different levels of your understanding of who you are, Lori, relative to sacred duty. I'm just going to anchor it. Mm-hmm. And so as co-initiation and initiation, particularly during this time of collective intelligence, of all of us coming to the fore, please tell the readers, what was it like when you became aware through this surrendering process that you were extending yourself into something? Can you remember that feeling of extending yourself into something? Or if it's not that word extending, what was it that began to give you the confidence that you were moving in the right direction?
Okay. So yeah, what it was called then was selfless service, which I had never done before, which was service. You wake up and you do your service. And it was an honor to be serving in the guru's home and in Mukti Dham, and to be there intimately with what was happening. The question is, what was touching me to the other, what was the question again?
So as you landed in this co-initiatory place through your selfless service, right? There's something that you described about breaking into molecules, right? So that you were not just the one thing at that point. Mm-hmm. You were one with everything.
Yes. Okay, go ahead. What's the question?
So then what was pulling you forward after that experience? What helped? Well,
the conditions of all of the people around me, because it was a community. And even in there in Sumneytown, we had our little gatherings. It was more intimate, but we had our satsangs. And there was this wonderful thing, like somebody goes to the store and buy the foods and somebody cooks it. This living in community that can't be recreated in a family. That there's something about, like, even a few weeks ago, Amrit came up here and we had a healing circle with people who we lived in the ashram together. And people, we've been out for what, 20 years? I don't know. And people are mourning that time still, and remembering that sisterhood and that brotherhood. And we know each other. We still know each other. We haven't seen each other for 20 years sometimes, but we still know each other. And we just deeply know each other. We shared this experience together. And having shared an experience, having shared a living experience of living a life that is of service together, of a similar service as a group and a collective, with a similar mission. Like, I didn't have to have my own mission statement. I didn't have to know what a mission was. We had it. Even if I don't know what it was, it was like, oh, you wash the dishes and it's okay. It'll be all right. You just wash the dishes and somebody else is going to pay the bills and someone else is going to go do the laundry. There's just something about collectively that we were all going somewhere. And I felt no need to be out in the world doing something else. There was no outside place to look, because we were all doing it, whatever it is, that moving towards our inner, moving towards spirit, moving towards, I wouldn't have used the word transformation back then, but moving towards God, moving towards samadhi on earth, moving towards, we were all moving collectively towards it. And we all had our shit together. But so we played out all of our shit within that circle as well. It wasn't like this always blissful thing and woohoo, everything's cool. But it always was okay. And actually it allowed more shit to come up because we could share, because there was this safe container for our stuff to come up. And this knowledge that when it did, the people around me were going to love me anyway. And they were going to help me reflect it back to me and help me with it. So that structure and that safety net with whatever shit you can call that was going on, and whatever, you know, unhealthy things were going on, which I'm not even sure there was that much of. I think it's a great container. Helped me stay really inside. So the outside helped me be really deep inside so that I could hear a calling and follow it. And I could hear us calling really strong. I don't know if everyone in the ashram got this because people were living there for different reasons. I was living there for more myself. I wasn't seeking the guru, seeking something like others were. But even though everyone around me was saying like, don't go be with him. Something inside of me felt really strong and really right on and resonated and knew like, I don't know why, but that's where I have to go. And so that same thing is still in me today. Like I just have this strength of trusting and stepping fearlessly with my fear. I have my fear, but I also have courage. And the courage that I have was to follow. I had the courage to follow my path was strengthened by the community that I was living in at the time, and by the prayers and my connection with my inner self. So they both went together. I had my inner self and my prayers, my messages from God or the heavens or God's will. And I would just follow it.
Okay.
So that's what got me there.
No, thank you. Thank you. So as I listen to you and I watch you move your arms and create space with your hands around your head and your heart, it gives me a sense that as you totally landed in this place of going forward because of this capacity to serve, right? And that your willingness to serve, that it wasn't a thinking about or even only feeling about, that there was a strong connection of some sort that we don't need to put language to today, but I want the readers to know that you were following something, and that if we create an opportunity to serve. Wait,
this is important.
Okay, go.
I had within me, and it may have been around, I had within me, the reason this is my story there, not the same as others somewhat, is I had within me this fluidity and ability to not be attached to things to be a certain way. And so it's not like I wasn't rebellious. It wasn't like there's a rule, so I'm going to rebel against it, because they had their rules, but I didn't take them as black and white. Like they said, they're guidelines. So I had within me this ability to navigate through without dogmatism, without, what do you call that when things are one way or the other? Not black and white. What's it called in yoga? I don't know. But, and so I could feel confident that that inside of me was touching my spirit, my God. And it begins with a D. Anyway. There's a more holisticness to it than, oh, you're supposed to be vegetarian. Oh, you're supposed to do this. Oh, you're supposed to do yoga. Like all of that kind of thing. So non-dualistic, that's what it is. So I wasn't dualistic, and Kripala wasn't dualistic. And so that container supported me in those ways. Like I didn't find it to be really dogmatic, because it was an ashram where guests came in from the outside. And so because they wanted the guests from the outside to have a comfort level, there wasn't this dogmatism. There was this, we honor you where you are. You can dance in the white things or not. And you can be, we just want you to get in touch with yourself. We want to help you. We just want to help you. We just want to serve you. And so people didn't come in and have to be a certain way. That was important.
Okay. So then let's track back a little bit relative to this particular discernment that you're shaping through our conversation. And I'd like to remember that you talked about yourself as a dancer and very flexible. And then I heard you speak about your lack of dogmatism, and you really didn't mind that there were guidelines, but they weren't the things that were meaningful to you relative to why you made decisions. So I think if we were to draw a picture of that, that part of you was very grounded in right here in the middle of a circle, but then because of your background, interest, discernment, capability, that kind of painting that you referred to when you became those many molecules, I'm getting a sense, Lori, that you already had a quality of knowing that was in you, that was embodied, that didn't have to do with making decisions. And so from a yogic perspective, and what you've learned during all these years of the many iterations of Phoenix Rising, please tell us, please tell the readers what you continue to call upon that continues to give you that fluidity, that discernment, that creativity. And if there's a yogic principle or something that you know that's yours that you can share.
I have a high level of comfort in stepping into the unknown. I have a high tolerance for moving forward without knowing how it's going to turn out. I read this book called The Congruent Life. And one of the qualities of a leader that's helpful is to be comfortable with not knowing how it's all going to turn out, with being comfort with that discomfort of not knowing. So if I get an intuition or a hit or a direction that my body or my spirit feels drawn, is called forth, if I have this calling and I hear a calling and I'm called forth to move in that direction, I don't have to know why. I just do it. Now, what's hard for me is people around me, I have to explain it to them linearly. And the minute I try to explain it linearly, it loses everything. And so I've had sidetracks where I've gone with the people who are linear, and then I haven't gone where it was the right way to go. And I've had to go, wait, it's over here, especially in Phoenix Rising, because Phoenix Rising could not have grown to what it is today if along the way we knew all the answers. It's one of those things where they teach in small business school. If you did your business plan and you really knew how it was going to turn out, you would never do this business. You just wouldn't have done it. So I followed into this place that became messy and unknown, but I have a certain level of tolerance for that. That's, you know, got its good sides and its bad sides. Is there a yogic term for that? I'm not, the yogic terms don't float to my head.
Okay.
That quickly, but on the eight limbs, I don't know if it's pratyahara. Like there's something, but there's something where I have comfort in the unknown and the faith. And faith would be a lot. I have this knowing that everything's always going to be all right. Even if the shit hits the fan, which it has in my life many times, many, many times, and some of it is today, but it's like, it's okay. I'm okay. Like right now, whatever's going on in the world and whatever's going on in my life, I'm going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay. Even if I die, I'm going to be okay. Even if people I love die, I'm going to be okay. So that gives me that courage to step forward. And when Michael was developing Phoenix Rising Yoga, so here's an example. He took a job out of Kripala working at this school down the road with troubled teens, DeSisto School. And it was a school for troubled teens, and their families came and they did Gestalt therapy. And he went there and he practiced the methods he was learning and developing. You can see his story to see where Phoenix Rising came from and his experience. But he was working at that school. And when I went to live with him, I needed a job. And he said, why don't you do massage? Back then, you didn't need a massage license in Massachusetts, anywhere, but you definitely didn't in Massachusetts. So I said, I don't know how to do massage. So he gave me one. And I pinned up, I did my first massage, I pinned it on the wall. I just said, fine, I'll do it. And it said 5 minutes on the head, 5 minutes on the right arm, 5 minutes on the left arm. And I just went on the body looking at my little sheet on the wall. And because I was a dancer in new bodies, like I got a full practice because people loved my massages. But I didn't go to school or know anything about it. I just did it. So when he was doing his work there, the therapists were saying, what are you doing with these kids? It's really great, blah, blah, blah. And then he started getting clients to do from Kripalu to do one-on-one sessions. And then they started saying, come and teach me, come and teach me. I want to learn how to do this. And he just came to me and he said, like, I don't know what to do. How could I do that? I don't know what to do. And I said, oh, well, let's just do it. This woman, Sue Varna, in New Jersey, set it up, and we drove to New Jersey. We set it up on weekends, and she got 6 people. And he said, should I do it for 6 people? And I just said, yeah, why not? 6 people, that's a start. You just got to start somewhere. And so we started with 6 people driving to New Jersey on weekends. And that was the beginning of it. But I didn't really think it through or plan it or do a business plan. Later, I went to school and I studied small business, and I learned structure. Phoenix Rising couldn't be where it is if there wasn't some sort of thing like that. But at the time, I just said, this is being called, someone's asking, it's being called for, let's go do it.
Okay. So I'm tracking as I listen to you from the generative field. I'm hearing you speak about people needing something. There being a partner, Michael in this case, who had the skills that they wanted, you already demonstrating that you have discernment around something that could grow. And so this trust, Lori, in yourself, this capacity without knowing to continue to move forward is a particular quality of innovation and entrepreneurship, as you know, as messy as it might be at times. But what I'd like to focus on for the benefit of the readers, when you decide, when something comes into form, when it crystallizes, right? That initial divine spark, the falling apart in the woods, the connection with Michael, the moving through the various business iterations. But what I'm hearing is this consistent acting in an instant, which is a particular quality from the presencing perspective of moving an idea to action despite the conditions. And so talk to us a little bit about how it feels.
Which has its bad side too. but so I must have, and I do have, so I don't know if I'm bragging about myself, but I actually have the skill to make things happen. I have organizational skills. I have, like, Michael, like, we call it the shitty first draft. Like, Michael can write something, but then I can take it and order it and put it in logic. So I am a fan, or what I create structure for things to grow in a way. So it's not, it could seem like, because I'm willing to step in the unknown, it could seem like there's no plan. So there isn't a plan, because I want the plan to be open to grow. I don't want to close it in, like someone says, you know, God has more in store for you than you have in store for yourself. So trust God, not yourself. I really live by that. However, I believe in the structure. I'm the gardener. So I plow the field. I don't just look at the field and say, God, grow some stuff. You know, I'm going to get this land and oh boy, it's going to grow. I would read books about plow. I would know, like, so I actually went to small business administration. I studied, I learned how to do spreadsheets. I meet with our accountant every single week. I go over, not our bookkeeper, our account, like both the bookkeeper and the accountant. Like, we look at spreadsheets and we create structure and we have boundaries and we have the kinds of things you just need in business for it to.
Right.
So here's an example. Here's a good example.
Hang on. I'm going to stop you just because we're running out of time right here. So in these last minutes, knowing that it's come into form, that what you've done over and over again from that very beginning time when you went down to clean the places where Bapaji meditated, where you tended and mended as you were waiting for that right next moment to create the structure of your personal life. I'm hearing a pretty beautiful thread of tending sacred wake-up moments, not only in yourself when you do the structuring of Michael's writing or whatever, but more importantly, that that's actually a core quality of your seeing And so I just want you to talk about a little bit the how you know in yourself that you're going to move forward, not the what you do or who you learned it from, but much more of that intrinsic inner place. So go back in your mind's eye to those moments in the forest. And then bring it forward in time, Lori, as you were no longer just a person, a me, but there was a service element throughout it all. And this has to do with your core offer. I know you well enough to know that this is part of the who you are as it relates to what the we of Phoenix Rising is. It would be really nice to see if we could find just a sentence or two for that from a deeply grounded, connected place. To welcome that part of who you are.
I'm not sure I understand.
It's okay. So what are you sensing?
I say the word container because I guess being all the dots is all beautiful, but then I would be dead and non-existent. And so the container that, so I create the container and then all those little dots have a solidity to them. They can be in the world and of the world and not just be going off into the ethers. Not that that's bad, but then how does that actualize? How does that buy you food and be practical in living in this world that we live in? And I don't know why, but I just have some kind of knowing to start at the beginning to set in place the things that allow room for growth. And the example that I was going to speak of was in 1989 or 90, we had Phoenix Rising and I created a FileMaker database when FileMaker was new. I hired a guy to create a FileMaker database and I learned about all the fields we needed because I knew that what we needed to know to grow was who are our students? This was before marketing on like gather email addresses. People didn't even have email back then. I was gathering names and physical addresses, but I wanted to store them and I wanted to always know what courses they took. So we created this FileMaker database that we still use today. And when the IOIT created accredited grandparenting and people needed their records, we had all their records from like the 90s. We could just look them up. We could just look up their name and say, oh, you took this here, you took that there, and you took that there.
Yeah.
And we knew how many hours were in the course because the data in the field wasn't just your name and address. It had everything in it. It had your courses. We have this thing of notes that goes back into the 90s of when you called that we keep. So somehow, I don't know why I knew what fields we needed back then, but somehow they're still... It's tweaked over the years, but we're still using FileMaker's probably mad at us because we haven't even come up to speed with all the power it can have, but it's still useful for us. So right now there's something that I'm doing in this moment. I don't know if it's fitting to speak of, but for legacy with Phoenix Rising, with all of this work in the world, who's going to hold that and how's that going to live? And is it going to be like when Pilates died or fall to Christ, like where everybody's like, oh, what do we do? What do we do? Who owns that? So 2 years ago, I suggested that some people in Phoenix Rising create a committee and look at creating a Phoenix Rising Professionals Association. And they've been meeting for 2 years. And last month, they filed their 501c6 and became a real professionals association. And now we're working our way through, there's a lot of stakeholders in the brand of in the name of Phoenix Rising Yoga Therapy, and Michael and Lori actually own the intellectual property. So how does that relate to this association? So we're working all of that out and we're going slow because I want it to be grounded in something that everyone's on the same field and that we're there an understanding that what we are creating in Phoenix Rising is actually an ecosystem. It's not a hierarchy. We're moving from a hierarchy. Michael and Lori own this, and then there's this, and there's the school, and there's practitioners, and there's this, and then these people are under this. So we're moving from that, that's the me, into the we of creating an ecosystem. And then within that ecosystem is all the people who are stakeholders in Phoenix Rising, and how there's not like Michael and Lori are in the center with all these things going out, but it's just more like this ecosystem that's all tied in together and supports and feeds each other. And each entity has a bit of like flexibility within it, and it moves and we play. But if I don't create the outside parts of that ecosystem safely, it won't be long. It will be months and, or, you know, years, 5 years from now, whatever. One of those parts is going to just break off, and then there's going to be trouble and, you know, mm-hmm. that I don't know for sure. But my imagination is we need to have the common ground has to be set in the bylaws and everything. And we need an intellectual property attorney. Like I'm like getting that set so that there's not this thing that can happen 5 years from now that's horrible, or 10 years from now or something. So I don't know what it's going to look like, but that's kind of what I'm stepping into to right now, is to move Phoenix Rising from a very patriarchal, hierarchical structure into this shared ecosystem with autonomy for some of the parts, but yet still tied together and still respecting each other and the stake people have. We have the highest stake, but a lot of people have stakes too. But how do you honor all of that is the question. And how does everyone fit into that and feel in that? How does everyone feel honored? And how do we address everyone's fears? Because when you go to change, fear is the first thing that comes up. So when you change something, you actually lose something. So anytime you change, you have to let go because you are losing something. So each stakeholder is going to lose something when we change. We're all going to lose something. And then how do we address that, and how do we see what we're gaining is the next phase to move into. So I kind of skipped from the very beginning all the way to the very end of Phoenix Rising with no middle ground.
Well, as you look into the future, knowing that there's something that you're letting go of, what are you hoping for? If you were to peek around the corner into the future and look back to a well-crafted ecosystem,
that's really easy. Right now, for the past few years of the current iteration of Phoenix Rising, which is about 4 years old, it's felt true and been true that if I don't wake up in the morning and keep things going, they will fall apart. You know, somehow we've made that true. That can't go on. It's not sustainable. The IAYT policy, well, we were part of the IAYT creating the accreditation. It's a we. There's no like, there's the IAYT and we're separate. We're all part of it. It's a nonprofit. We were all on those board meetings and those meetings. However, when the accreditation did happen, we moved from being one of six schools to being one of, like, I don't know, 60 now. It's unending, the number of schools. That changed the business structure, the business model. We all get less students. We all can't function in the same way we used to. And there's new people on the playing field. So that transition through this time, which has been over the past 4 years, has been excruciating at times. Some of the worst years of my life, some of the worst struggles, some of the waking up in the morning, like, oh my God, is this going to keep, how are we going to get through this in order financially? Mostly it's financial. And then the hours that it takes to do the accrediting, and that you still have to run your business. And all of us yoga schools are small businesses. We're a couple of people here. And I think that we've been, like, I'm a creative person. So I just look at it like, okay, we need to reinvent ourselves again. So it's not going to be the same old school. It's going to be reinvented. And in that reinvention, I'm making sure that Lori isn't holding it all. In the reinvention, there needs to be that ecosystem where we're holding it together, and it's not being held unproportionately by any of the folks in the ecosystem, because then it dies. The ecosystem won't exist. So So that's what we're creating. And I don't know what it's going to look like yet. I tried something last year that failed, and now we're trying another thing this year. The pandemic has been amazing because the minute we put our courses online, they're selling like hotcakes. And I feel proud of us because when we do our online webinars, they're not just a webinar. We have 30 people there and we have 7 staff and we break the people off into groups of 10. So we had this webinar last week. Michael does some teaching and it's going on this week. Michael does some teaching with all of us there. And then we go into breakout rooms and there's a facilitator in each room with just 10 or 12 people. And they all get to share and hear each other just as if we were in the room together. And then we come back. And then we do a yoga class and they go into dyads in the breakout. You can do 2 people in a breakout room. You can have 50 breakout rooms and they share with each other. And then they come back and then they go into their groups of 10 and they share with each other. And it's so beautiful because everyone's being seen and heard. It's not just a webinar where you're being lectured at. So we found a way that was close to our hearts to bring the connection we want to have in real life into the Zoom meetings. And it requires a lot of people. That's why when we have a webinar, we have a tech person. We have one person who's a skilled facilitator for every 10 or 12 people. We have the leader. And it's awesome. We're connecting in a really deep way.
Yes. Okay. So this is exactly where we need to land, this amazing capacity to create something from just the smallest spark of intuition, Lori. If the readers get nothing else from this, that your deep faith in helping to make things happen and the space that you've given yourself to try and try again, that's a very critical part of the path of bringing spirit into life, bringing your belief of whatever it is, you were calling it God, this connection. Mm-hmm. And yes, you spoke clearly about some of these business skills, etc. But if we were to actually take the beauty of what you just described and link it back to some of your earliest experiences, I'm seeing a great deal of consistency in being able to really optimize something that people had no idea about at the beginning. Right? And so that's an embodiment practice. That's an embodied knowing that comes from somewhere else than having an idea and I have to go and find out how to do it. So I just want to welcome that heart intelligence that you have such a big amount of. And let's just land together while we close out so that you can reflect on the readers and what else you might want to tell them as you distribute your passion into this online virtual world and your willingness to try new things, this desire for a legacy that is much more ecocentric than hierarchical, everyone belonging, everyone have a part, a voice. See if there's any other words of wisdom.
It's the word that's coming to me is calling. If you have a calling, answer it. If you have a calling, go forth.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was great. I haven't told that story in ages or maybe ever.
I'll be in touch.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.